Hello, everyone. This is JVL here with my best friend, Tim Miller, and sitting in for Sarah Longwell, our Bulwark colleague, A.B. Stoddard. A.B., welcome back to the show, and please give us the t-shirt reveal.
Yes. Trump's trial reminded me that I am a Pence donor, as I've revealed on the dark side before. I bought this t-shirt, Too Honest, Mike Pence for president on the back.
That's fantastic.
Right before I joined the Bulwark for $37. Right on brand. And the reason I remembered this yesterday and wore it today was because my information then went to Nikki Haley and then went to Donald Trump, who blasted me yesterday and said I stormed out of court yesterday. They think I'm finished, but I'll never surrender. And it reminded me that he is going to bullshit his supporters about what happened in court every single day, and they will believe him. The judge cannot go on CNN and disagree, and it's going to drive me fucking bonkers.
He even could, actually, because they don't watch CNN. And so unless the judge was going to go on Real America's Voice to correct the record, I don't think it would matter. JVL, though, we're discussing the green room because of AB's donations. Relative donations, and I'm excited to hear you reveal
yours. So I have made two political donations lifetime, both of which were for the merch. They had nothing to do with politicians. And the first was the Rick Santorum 2012 presidential campaign when he was wearing his blue sweater vest, and I just thought this thing is an instant classic. And so I gave him like whatever the $25 or $50 you needed to get in order to get the vest.
Was there a Santorum joke on there?
It just has like his little eagle, and it was like I was just going to give it away to. I think I gave it away to a Weekly Standard reader as a gag, but the fulfillment took like 18 months, and so this is why AB, I was amazed that you got your T-shirt so quick, because I assumed that in political circles, you know, you give them your money, and then 8 months after the election is over, you get your merch.
Oh no, Mike Pence is too honest. He would not run a ship that way.
And my second one was Jared Polis, your guy, and it's because he was putting out Jared Polis NFTs, and I just thought this is too good to be true, and so I think it was $50. So I'm a proud owner. I think of because they're numbered. I think number 37 of the Jared Polis NFTs, and maybe when I'm in Denver, I'll go over to the governor's mansion if governor's mansion is in Denver. I don't actually know what the capital of that weird state is, and I'll ask him to sign my NFT.
Well, that was like kind of a soft reveal about how we might be having an event in Denver. Still working on that, but we do have an event in Philly coming up May 1st and Washington, D.C. May 15th.
Bring your batteries.
Bulwark.com/events. Please buy tickets. Come hang out. I do want to say my two donations are much more out of spite than both of yours.
Oh, spite donations are the
best. I have a couple like I donated to my own candidates or I bought a t-shirt, but like I have two message sending spite donations in my life. Are you ready for them? Number one shows you the full circle we've all come on. I spite donated to Mike Enzi because I was so pissed at Liz Cheney for challenging him and screwing her sister by not coming out for gay marriage when she challenged him in that primary. And I was so mad at her. And now we have all come full circle and Liz Cheney and I have both done the right things in our life and we are aligned and we've both made amends for our mistakes. And so I do think that's funny. I was a Mike Enzi donor. And my other one was also, it's gay spite related, really. It was Doug Jones. And this Doug Jones thing ended up becoming a whole thing. I sent
the
out
Roy
a tweet.
Moore Doug Jones race?
Roy Moore Doug Jones race. And this was when I was still Republican in good standing. And I sent out a tweet that was like, this is the first time I've ever voted for or donated to a Democrat, but fuck you, Roy Moore, and fuck you, everybody that's supporting this Afiba file. I'm supporting Doug Jones. And it became such, it went so viral that literally an NPR stringer, I was living in Oakland at the time, came to my home to do a story on this on this weird gay Republican living in Oakland who just donated to a Democrat for the first time. They did like a soft feature on me on the local NPR. So, you know, those are so I think this is good. Mike Pence, Mike Enzi, Doug Jones. We're going to pretend like you didn't say Rick Santorum. Jared Polis.
That's a good foursome. This is the, the cross
section. Tim, it is amazing. First of all, Mike Enzi was a really great guy and a great member and a
serious. Is he dead? Why did you say was? Or is he a bad guy now or is he dead?
He's passed away.
Oh, okay. R.I.P.
Am I going to be wrong about that?
I don't know. Sebastian will check that out.
Sebastian is furiously Googling Mike Enzi.
It is amazing to remember that time when people were absolutely furious with Liz Cheney for challenging Mike Enzi. It is just a wild, wild look back into the four times. But I do think you got the most mileage having a soft feature done on you.
Yeah. My NFT, that thing, the value of that poll. I mean, honestly, the value of my Trump Truth Social stocks versus my Jared Polis NFT. I mean, also, I'm gonna have to quit this gig because I'm gonna retire off of those things.
Do you have any recollection of the piece I wrote for the Bulwark when I bought the White House coin of Trump with Kim Jong Un for this? Yes. I bought the Summit coin, you guys.
Summit coin.
Hannah did awesome art, and it was amazing.
Do you still have it?
It's somewhere in here.
I mean, in your safe deposit box.
It must be somewhere.
In your Swiss account vault.
Yeah.
Okay. Got a bunch of things to talk about today. We're going to talk about the Trump trial. We're going to have an after action report on a recent Tim podcast, which was so big that it couldn't be contained by a podcast. But we're going to start in the House of Representatives, the People's House, where Speaker Mike Johnson is just, he's spinning plates or he's juggling footballs or watching monkeys fuck footballs. I don't know, but there's something weird happening. He's trying to pass four bills in a week after, you know, months of doing nothing. We have both Marjorie Taylor Greene and Thomas Massey who have said they're coming to take his gavel. It's all moving very fast and it's all amazing. And Tim, please go first.
Maybe by the time this is out, we have bill text. It's kind of fun. This has been a great history of, the last three speakers, Republican speakers, where it's like they'll leak something to Jake Sherman, fast break Jake Sherman, who's over at Fishbowl. And it's like, I've got the plan. It's going to happen now. All right. I've got the crazies on board. I've got the regulars on board. We're going to leak it. We figured it out. And then it goes out and there's some excitement on Twitter and people are like, okay, they're going to do it. They're going to have these votes. And then it's like 20 minutes later, some lunatic, you know, puts out, I would like John Boehner's head on a spike before I vote for this. And like, this is what happened yesterday where like Mike Johnson finally thought he had it. And then 20 minutes later, Thomas Massey says, I resign, sir, resign now. And I'm supporting Marjorie Taylor Greene. So it turns out he doesn't have it. They were supposed to have released the text by yesterday, Tuesday afternoon, so that they could follow the 72-hour rule. To where people can read the bill and then vote on Friday because they go on another vacation.
You mean where people can pretend to read the bill?
Yeah. Weren't they just on vacation? Right. Apparently they have another vacation next week. It's hard to keep track of all these spring breaks these guys have. I thought my kid had a lot of vacation time because we have Mardi Gras break and spring break here in Louisiana, but she's going to like triple the amount of school that they're going to Congress. But so they have another vacation next week. And so now it's still not, we're taping this Wednesday morning. And so we'll see what the actual, you know, he's meeting again with the crazy caucus to be like, what can I give you to make sure you don't, you know, motion to vacate me. And, you know, the fourth bill in this package is already weird. It like combines like TikTok with a new Lend Lease Act with like we're seizing some Russia. You know, there's some good stuff in there. And it's just like the reality is these guys can't pass anything. Well, they can pass one thing. I want to get to that in a second. They can condemn things, but they can't actually pass anything. And, you know, we're on month six now. There are more deaths in Ukraine overnight, another attack. And, you know, there doesn't seem to be, no one has come to the realization that we've come to on this podcast for many, many months, which is that a handful of good Republicans, quote unquote, have to do the right thing and work with Democrats, do a discharge petition, or else it's not going to happen. Like they don't have the votes. Maybe, and who knows, maybe they'll figure finally after long last that he'll get the Democrats to bail them out again. But it is really, and it's just an epic clusterfuck.
AB, so it seems like Johnson is counting on the Democrats to help him here. But after seemingly gotten a deal with them to help him, decided to go back to the conservative caucus to see if he can sweeten it for them, which is maybe going to, is he trying to screw the Dems here? I don't quite understand from his perspective what he thinks he's doing.
No, he's not trying to screw the Democrats. I think that, I mean, first of all, Mike Johnson he thinks he's Moses. And he said yesterday, in his professorial tone that they need a steady hand at the wheel. And he said, I regard myself, I think of myself, I regard myself as a wartime speaker. So he's telling...
Who is the greatest challenge since any speaker since the Civil War, I think.
Yes. So he is telling donors who are saying, we're not going to fund this shit show one more month. You've lost members. They're leaving early to fuck you over intentionally. You all hate each other and you're trying to sink your majority. So he's telling them, as he told President Zelensky and others, that he intends to do the right thing. So what he has designed lets him look like he's doing the right thing and that he's trying to please everybody and navigate the choppy waters and govern. And I get, JVL and I have talked about this, I now and then get a little hopeful that he has an ounce of shame and wants to do the right thing and feels terrible about Ukraine. And in the FISA debate, when Trump, either because he does have some kind of dementia onset, confused and conflated Title I of FISA with Section 702 with FISA a week and a half ago.
He either did it intentionally or not. I'm not sure it's dementia. I just don't think he can read.
But when he did it, Johnson stuck his neck out and said, you know, I know members are confused about this and they're making up stuff about this, but they have to go to the SCIF as I did. And he said, they need to seek the same information. You've got to be fully informed. And he defied Trump on this. So I have my moments where I think he's either trying to do the right thing or he's signaling to donors that he intends to do the right thing. Either one, right, gets him to this middle land where he's Moses in the middle of all the madness and he's going to do the right thing and save everybody. He's not. Everything that Tim just described, this entire like four-step process, four bills, but under a single rule, but open to amendment. And the minute you open this up, you sink it and you kill it. The Senate was never going to, this was never going to work out. And so it's designed to look like he cares and he's really sorry it didn't work out. And then, all he had to do was pass the Senate bill. So he's on this call after Iran attacks Israel and President Biden and Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries all say to him, Mike, we've got to pass the Senate bill. Like, there's no other thing we can do. And this is the mess that he gave us. It's completely intentional. It's designed to be a shit show that looks like he's a good guy trying to do the right thing. I don't think he's going to get kicked out. And I think that he can count. He knows he can get on the Democrats if they try to take his job. I don't think Marge has the votes. I don't think it'll happen. I think she just wants to keep fundraising off it. But if that happens, yes, he knows that this is such a gimme for the Democrats that they will gladly call out on the House floor that they support Speaker Mike Johnson keeping his job because they want to look like they're governing. So he knows he has that in his pocket. And that's my take.
I have a question for you, AB, one follow-up. Or maybe this is more a question for Mike Johnson, for Fast Break Jake or Joe Perticone to ask. Who is he at war with? He's a wartime speaker.
Woke.
It's like the Democrats, like the other...
He's at war with woke, Tim.
Woke. Because the other party, the opposition party, is trying to help him. Like, they want to cut a deal with him. And the president of the opposition party wants to cut a deal with him. And so, like, who is he at war with exactly? It seems like he's at war with... like Marjorie Taylor Greene? Is that the war? It's a civil war.
We all war with ourselves in a way.
Yeah, it's an internal war.
You know, there are two wolves. There are two wolves inside each of us, Timothy. A good wolf and a bad wolf. You got to choose which one to feed.
I think he's really a pompous dude. And the idea of, he's already invoked Moses. Why are we even bringing up the wartime thing, right? Why? This is just, it's deeply pathetic.
It's a Christian war. It's a religious war.
Right.
So, AB, you follow this stuff more closely than I do. So I just want to drill down here. So your view is that basically this is a grand strategy on Johnson's behalf to A, keep donors on board, while B, keeping his job.
And looking like
he has no illusions. Right. Looking like he's trying to pass the stuff when he knows it won't pass. And when he will then not be willing to do any of the stuff that would let it pass. Like, for instance, if he released members to vote for the discharge position, right? That would then, I assume, trigger his removal as speaker, right? So he really is he cares about holding onto the job here.
Yes, he does. And I think that he believes that he was called to this moment. I'm sorry. It sounds absurd, but that's what I think he believes. And I think that so he goes to Mar-a-Lago last Friday. Trump says, maybe we could give Ukraine a loan instead of a gift. I'm here to back Mike Johnson. Last night, as we know, he said, we'll see what happens with Mike Johnson. So he's already thrown him overboard. He's not standing out there and trying to make a public showing against Marjorie Taylor Greene and Thomas Massie for Mike Johnson to keep his job. But Mike Johnson, as I said, he knows that Jeffries is going to provide a couple of guys are going to give him the votes to keep his job, no matter what happens. That's as plain as day. It's just too good politically for the Democrats to not do it. They're going to do it. They're going to look like the grown-ups. They're going to get credit from voters for it.
But that's even worse for Johnson in the long term, right? To be a speaker whose speakership depends on the votes of Democrats.
Yes, of course it is. But I think that the way
Boehner survived like that for years.
You could say the discharge petition is terrible for him. Well, everything's terrible for him. So if he lets this four-part, clusterfuck go down, then people did a discharge petition without me. It looks like I can't control the House floor. Well, that's already been decided. And then someone does the motion to vacate after a discharge petition. He keeps his job from the Democrats and the aid goes through.
I mean, so the people understand what Johnson is dealing with here. I want to Republican Representative Garrett Graves yesterday said, was asked, does the speaker strategy make sense to you? This is what Congressman Garrett Graves said. In a word, no. The reality is you have to keep in mind President Biden asked for Ukraine. President Biden asked for Israel. President Biden asked for aid to Taiwan, and President Biden supports the changes to TikTok. What are Republicans getting out of this?
This fucking douchebag, this douche canoe, Garrett Graves, just for some context, he's the Baton Rouge congressman. He got drawn out.
Well, I could have done a voice.
Yeah.
He's Man, a Baton what Rouge. A missed opportunity.
He's kind of not really, though, because he's a Baton Rouge congressman who is a fancy boy. He was Kevin McCarthy's, little right-hand man. He's one of these establishment guys that's fake MAGA. Okay, so Garrett Graves is Mike Gallagher, but from the South. All right, like that's who Garrett Graves is. All right, so he is not, this is not, like dealing with Marge or Lauren Boebert or Paul Gosar. Like this is, that quote is from somebody who, if you asked I won't name the person from segment three. If you ask some of our friends in the conservative media and the mainstream conservative media who these closet normal Republicans are, who the normal Republicans are, they're talking about Garrett Graves would be the type of person they would mention. So that's what we're dealing with here. And his quote is he can't support Johnson, because he doesn't feel like the Republicans are getting anything out of this. So there's two elements to this. One is these guys butthurt because he was Kevin McCarthy's friend. So I guess there's just some childishness to that. But just like how bad of a quote this is on the face of it. I mean, this is like he is literally saying that the Republicans are not for Ukraine aid, Israel aid, Taiwan aid, or the changes to TikTok. Republicans aren't getting anything out of those policies, right? That Johnson has to get something that Republicans want. So, I mean, this undermines like the core argument of everybody in the, Wall Street Journal apologist class of Republicans that are like, oh, Joe Biden doesn't want to support Israel. Joe Biden is distancing himself from Bibi. We have a Republican member of Congress saying directly that the Republicans don't want aid for Israel, that it's Biden who wants it. Biden wants Israel aid. Republicans don't. This is a Republican congressman who was in leadership till recently. So as plain as day, right there in the quote, that Republicans need to get something to own the libs. That's what the subtext is here. Biden needs to be owned, and Biden can't be owned through with aid to Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan because Biden wants Ukraine, and Taiwan. So Biden needs to be owned. That's the thing that's how Republicans get something out of this is by owning the libs. That's what this guy thinks his job is, and he's one of the normal ones. And he's one of the normal ones, supposedly. So like, okay, that's what you're dealing with in the House conference right now. Like these just nihilistic, childish shitbirds. Garrett Graves.
Boy, when Sarah's not here, we can say all sorts of stuff.
I'm not. Blue. I'm as mad as Tim. I'm not going to bang anything because this whole thing will fall over. But Garrett Graves was a staffer not only in the House, but in the Senate, like Kevin McCarthy. He is a complete institutionalist, and he is known by his colleagues as a serious legislator and policy wonk.
I mean, he sure sounds like it
to me. Who has studied all this stuff and knows how bipartisan deals are made. He was assigned by Kevin McCarthy, not as budget chairman or a member of the leadership, to honcho the entire debt deal with Joe Biden on the debt ceiling last May. And this is what he said about it. We didn't go in and ask for the sun, moon, and stars. We calibrated our ask with our leverage that resulted in what I think is a pretty conservative win, cutting spending by $2.1 trillion, the largest spending reduction in spending history. Okay, everyone in MAGA hated the deal, and Kevin McCarthy loses his job over it ultimately. But he is a realist. He is a measured non-radical who thinks that the radicals in Congress, because of their social media profiles, are misleading the American people. He tells the Ripon Society on February 5th of this year.
2 months ago.
He says we mislead them and made them believe that we can achieve this. And anything short of balancing the budget tomorrow or absolutely closing the border and having the wall built next week, anything short of going back to the energy policies of the Bush administration is a failure. He wants incremental wins, he tells them. And he says that the whole representation of what's in the best interests of the American public is being doused right now by this dysfunction in government, this civil war that's happening in our party. And to some degree within the Congress where politics reign instead of what's best for the country. He's so upset and despairing about the breakdown of the system. And you know what? He has beef with Scalise and their districts are adjourning, and there's some kind of internecine leadership BS where Graves said that on purpose because he's so afraid he's being run down now that his buddy Kevin is out and he has beef with Scalise, who's majority leader, that he had to intentionally say this douchebag, and you'll have to tell me later what douche canoe means, this douchebag comment to try to save face
like bigger than
with
a douchebag.
Mike Johnson and MAGA.
All right, so AB, what I'm hearing you say then is that he agrees that Mike Johnson is a wartime speaker. Okay.
Probably.
Did you get the douche canoe definition from Sebastian in?
No, we're not going to do that. And I think it's pretty good. I'm going to save you from my. I have some stories. Boy, I have stories for you. We're not going to do that. What we're going to do is we're going to talk about how this show is sponsored by Green Chef. Green Chef is the number one meal kit for clean eating and ranked the number one meal kit overall by U.S. News and World Report. They deliver quality whole foods with limited processed ingredients, including low added sugar and sodium smart options, so you can eat with a clean conscience. Each week, choose from 80 plus flavor packed options, and you can mix and match meals, not to mention flavors from their different dietary preferences, like keto, Mediterranean, and more. Preparing each meal can take as little as 30 minutes for dinner or 10 minutes for lunch. And did you know Green Chef is owned by another one of our sponsors, HelloFresh? HelloFresh people. So now you can switch between the two and have a wider array of meal plans to choose from. Plus, since April is Earth Month, you should know sustainability is a key part of the Green Chef brand, the company offsetting 100% of delivery emissions and 100% of plastic in each box. I mean, that's all very nice, but I'll tell you the only thing I care about, which is that the meal prep is very easy and my children all like it.
Important.
So for me, in my household, the idea of getting all four of the children to eat a meal and not complain because they like it is the holy grail. And there is nothing else that fits that. I can't do macaroni and cheese. We have, you know, there's like orange chicken and then the Green Chef meals we've gotten. So that's the highest endorsement that exists. Go to greenchef.com/nextlevel50 and use code nextlevel50 to get 50% off
Whoa.
Plus 20% off your next 2 months. That's 50% off plus 20% off your next 2 months when you go to greenchef.com/nextlevel50. Start enjoying the number one meal kit for eating well today.
I want the code for the next sponsor to be Garrett Graves sucks balls. Go to...
You know, maybe we'll ask them for that. Maybe we'll ask them for that. All right, so
Donald Trump is, can I do one more congressional rant? I have one more.
Sure.
It's just a brief one.
It could be a three-hour show. That's all right.
It's worth noting. This is a great show. It's a good short show. Congress did do something this week. I just think it's important to acknowledge when Congress does something.
Yeah, they can govern.
They passed a resolution that the slogan, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," is anti-Semitic, and its use must be condemned. And here's the thing. You want to do these fucking things, like we're condemning random things. It's fine. But to me, it seems like the anti should be like, you have to do other stuff. Like, you know, if you can't just condemn things. Or else, I really do think we might be on a path. Because this is like the entire Republican conference, save maybe two or three people. And then like maybe eight Democrats probably are for this, would be for this plan, which is that Congress should just stop legislating altogether. The executive should do all the policymaking, and all Congress should do every day is vote on whether people's tweets are offensive or not. And
Congress,
we can just take turns
that as a relief.
Putting up different tweets and putting up different slogans and be like, racist or not racist. And that's Congress now for the 2030s. I think that that's maybe what might be where we're heading. I think that'd make a lot of people happy.
You think I'm kidding? I think that most of the Republican Party would view that as a relief, because they believe, you know, as Madison Cawthorn put it, that they ought to be just doing comms, right? They came to Washington to get onto Fox News.
Yeah.
And if they could just tweet without having to worry about all the other stuff, that'd be great. All right.
But it's also part of, you know, people should learn about Project 2025 and the dystopian hellscape that Donald Trump has planned for us with his Christian nationalist friends. It's all to vastly centralize all of the power in the executive.
Correct.
And take away our representation anyway.
I mean, AB, you'd have to believe that things are going to be totally different in a second Trump term if you believe that. We'll get to that in a minute. The trial is ongoing. We've had 2 days of trial, and in each day, the former president, who is a fit and vigorous man, has fallen asleep before the lunch break.
I usually like to doze off after lunch. Maybe that's...
If this had happened to Joe Biden, I mean, a solid month of coverage, there would be 18 stories in the New York Times. It happens to Trump, and it's just like, meh.
I brought it up on MSNBC. I wasn't asked, but I just kind of brought it up as a non sequitur. Just because I
had that
like
go
somebody
over.
Should mention it. It was fine. The Chris Jansen was just kind of like, okay, you know, and then asked me a question about something.
So nobody
else.
Cares. Nobody cares. Do you guys have thoughts on the trial? I mean, I hope you're level setting some expectations and bringing them way down. Both of you, yes?
So I think on Monday morning, I thought, oh, he has the power to make people think that it's a petty case and engender some kind of sympathy. And now I feel like there's kind of a pathetic protest outside. It's going to be the same thing every day. Wears the same clothes. He goes in and out of the same doors, and he goes to camera and says the same thing. And he likes, now he's going to do these stunts at the bodega, and he trashes the judge, and he looks like hell. And I just think, I'm thinking now on Wednesday that Americans are going to be like, shut up, you boring, ranting lunatic. Like, it's kind of making me feel now that I don't know that it's going to, I don't think a conviction changes the course of this campaign. I really don't. And of course, an acquittal empowers him. But I feel like this whole idea that he can change the narrative and gain sympathy and support by being a defendant in a trial, I'm not buying it now. It just seems so dull and monotonous. And I mean, I know JVL has promised me drama. There's going to be all sorts of salty characters coming through and testifying. But so far, it's like, you know.
Tim?
I know I'm supposed to talk about the what this means for Trump and blah blah blah. I'm not so sure it means anything. That it does. I think we're kind of on a similar trajectory. And so, can I tell you the thing about this trial that's brought me a little bit of joy? The news brings you so little joy these days, and so I like to try to focus on it. Have you been reading the reports from the courtroom about the challenges to the jurors? I just love the menagerie of the human experience. You know, it's unlike JVL, humans. I love hearing their stories. Like, there's the person who was like, I went to the lake for 6 weeks with no Wi-Fi, and I don't even know what this trial is about. Like, I love that person. Then there's a person who then there was a lengthy debate over whether one juror should be expelled because he reads the Borowitz report. It's like the judge is, you're going back and forth, and it's like, well, the Borowitz report enjoyer, it turns out that is not disqualifying. Maybe it's disqualifying in a certain way, but not for this jury. And, you know, going, and then they're like looking at the face, like this one person, and it's like, was this person lying or is this just a weird human? But it was election night of 2020 and people were honking in their cars and this person's posting on Facebook, like, everybody should honk too. It's so fun. And they're asked about this and they're like, why were you doing that? Was it because you were so excited Trump lost? And they're like, no, I thought it was cool that people were honking. It's like, is that person lying because they want to be on the jury so bad? Or is it just the great and good people of New York that some people just like the honking parties? I don't know. So I've enjoyed that part of it. And I've enjoyed Donald Trump falling asleep and making fun of him for that. And that's about all my thoughts at day three of this trial.
You know, us New Yorkers.
Yeah, you can tell.
We're used to celebrity. We're, you know, we don't get blown away by the big lights. You're like, hey, look, it's Brad Pitt, Madonna, whatever. It's Tuesday. Right? I mean, that's how we are. And I think it is beautiful.
Were you
thinking
you might get called to the jury? That would have been interesting for you to be in the jury pool.
I don't know how many years you have to be living in the borough before you qualify. I think there's a homesteading aspect to it. Anyway, I do think it's funny how the people on the resistance left are just so honestly self-reporting. Like, yeah, I read the Borowitz report. You know, like you would think that if this was some gigantic crime family conspiracy, then there would be a bunch of resistance people doing their very best to appear not resistancy so as to railroad your favorite totally innocent president. But that's not where we are. Okay.
It also speaks to the deep state conspiracies, how stupid they are. We all know they're stupid, but it's like in any of these scenarios about like, oh, the deep state's out to get Trump. I wish people read, you know, I wish that Newsmax viewers read, because I'd like to like send them like, look at these, like, look at just the human frailty here. Like, this is not a big plot. Like, these are just a range of humans, some smart, some stupid, some pretty, some ugly, you know, some nice, some mean, you know, it's just the whole human experience at play here. And everybody gets a chance to argue about it back and forth. You know, like, there's no plot. But
Lou
anyway.
Reed wrote a song about it. Okay. You like that? You like that, Tim?
I do like that.
A Lou Reed poll? Come on, man.
I wish I had seen Lou Reed before he died on the street of New York like you. That's the kind of celeb sightings that I would
I mean,
would
back
enjoy.
In the day when I was
speaking of dead
up,
people, by the way, Mike Enzi did die July 2021. He broke his neck.
Tragic.
Bicycling accident, which tragically. Is really sad. R.I.P. Mike Enzi.
Okay. Now let's get to the thing that everybody wants to hear. Tim, you had a podcast yesterday. Would you like to tell the class about it?
I had a great podcast. It was with New York Times columnist Ross Douthat. I don't know if you know a lot about him, JVL. He's kind of interesting. He's sort of heterodox views on
issues. He's the future
of conservatism. I'm not sure if you're a big reader of his column or not. You know, look, I don't want to make a habit of having people on the podcast and then coming on this podcast and dunking on them. I'll just say this, and then I'm interested in the thoughts that you two have having listened to it. I just think it's very revealing how hard it is for somebody that knows Donald Trump is dangerous and immoral and irredeemable to like come up with rationales for not opposing him. It's like very challenging. And it's that's why I want to invite more people who have that view on the podcast, because hopefully I'll be enlightened by one of them. at some point to try to understand, because I felt like Ross, who is very eloquent and very smart on certain topics, like when that topic comes up, it's like, you know, it's trying to like debating Jell-O, you know, or smoke. And it's a very challenging, and you immediate moves to a meta, right? Like rather than speaking for myself about why I would understand voting for Trump, now I'm going to change the topic and pretend like I'm an imaginary Hispanic voter on the border, you know, who didn't go to college. I'm like, okay, well, I'm not asking you to explain. We have a podcast for that, the Focus Group podcast. It's very good, where you can hear why real people are supporting Trump or not supporting Trump. I'm just trying to understand why you don't, you know, cannot clearly say whether you think Donald Trump or Joe Biden is more threatening. And that was a very challenging question for him to answer. And the description, the explanations were just kind of hard to follow, were rather hard to follow. And I think that that's revealing in a certain way. So that's what I'll say about the interview. I think it's worth listening to.
What did you make of it? I thought it was a great show. AB, what were your thoughts?
Well, Tim is doing the right thing, and providing a safe space for anti-antis it's very revealing, and it's a worthy exercise, and he does it well. And I really commend you for the whole discussion and the idea. And I'm glad you're trying to lure more of them into these really calm and measured conversations. And I didn't think it got tense once. I thought it was really enjoyable to listen to, but it was so illustrative of this tension where it gives people like Ross some kind of comfort to say that in the bulwark community of Never Trumpers, we're doing something wrong, but they are trying to stay on this cleaner, more clarified path that they also cannot describe or defend. So at one point he says to Tim, I'm actually trying to convince people not to support Trump in 2024. It was so insane. And he ended up, of course, he got very incensed at the end, and everyone has to listen to every minute, about how it's turned that Trump's detractors, of course, we've heard this so many times from the anti-anti crowd, have turned his critics into deranged people who drool and can't, you know, complete a sentence. And it was sad in that way. He's very tortured. He admitted he has not decided what he will do faced with this decision. So he didn't know how to rank Biden as a president. It was complete and utter mess, but Tim handled it masterfully. It is an important discussion. Ross was actually super, I thought, you know, friendly and charming and took it well, but he did run around in many, many tortured circles. And it's hard to be an anti-anti.
Yeah. I know that people want JVLs to do this, but the weird thing about that is like, right, I began the discussion on just policy, like outside of this. And it's like Ross is kind of like thoughtful on foreign policy. I disagreed. He was a little soft on Putin for my taste in certain things, but we kind of discussed back and forth. And he was directionally.
Well, Ross is just an isolationist.
Yeah, but directionally sympathetic.
Ross is a thoughtful Buchananite isolationist.
Yeah, but he was directly sympathetic to the way that Biden has kind of managed, you know, the more isolationist and the more hawkish elements of his own coalition. And like we talked about that. And so then, you know, to go from that, like a kind of a detailed policy discussion, to like not being able to just kind of say whether you think that Donald Trump was worth it, whether he's a good president or not, whether he's a better president than Joe Biden, can just sort of lend you to be like there's something here you're not saying. And I think JVL, and that's what I'm interested in JVL's take. I think JVL might think that he actually likes Trump. Maybe that's true. But to me, it might be that like actually he agrees with us, basically. Obama and Biden have been better, but he doesn't want to say it because that you can't be the conservative New York Times columnist and say that. I literally could be either. That is the one area where I failed, I think, in the interview, because you can't tell because it's so elusive. So anyway, JVL, what was your take?
Yeah, I have some global criticisms of the way in which Ross sort of unequally views the world. For instance, throughout your conversation, there was a lot of benefit of the doubt giving. Like, we have no idea what the pro-life movement will look like in 20 years from now. A lot of like, you know, was the Dobbs decision bad for the pro-life movement? And Ross's answer was like the old Chinese proverb about the guy getting the free horse. Like, too soon to tell, too soon to tell. And it's like, okay, that's an interesting worldview. But then when there was a moment when he mentioned Kamala Harris, he just dismissed her as incompetent. And I was just like, I would like you to show your work on that. Because, like, what, I mean, I agree Kamala Harris has political problems in how she's perceived. She certainly had an executive problem in running a national campaign for president. But in her time as vice president and her time as senator, like, what are the examples of incompetence? You know, like, it just, again, Ross is very, very eager to bend over backwards and extend every benefit of the doubt to his perceived allies. And his charity for his perceived enemies, as exhibited by, like, you know, his, like, when he got wound up about the left, at the end, I was like, dude is 5 minutes away from talking about kitty litter boxes in schools. It was really weird. There was another moment that bothered me a little bit. He was talking about how, you know, this is something we see a lot, how the time to stop Trump was at the second impeachment. And he was talking about how that was such an important moment and the Senate Republicans failed. And so I was like, I don't remember Ross writing about that a lot. And so I went back to the archives. And between January 13, 2021, which is when the House passed the Articles of Impeachment, and February 13th, which was the day the Senate acquitted Trump, Ross wrote 7 pieces. The first of which was about impeachment. And I remember this because this piece, he started out by talking about me. And sort of, you know, chastised me for always having the darkest possible view and, you know, you can't trust me and blah, 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 blah. And he then said that, you know, he thinks, of course, the most likely thing is that McConnell won't get rid of him, but maybe he will. And, you know, like he always is, Ross was wrong. The next column was called the Biden Opportunity. Then there was Joe Biden's Catholic Moment. Then there was a sort of generic how Trump ate populism. Then we had San Francisco schools, radicalism in the pandemic, long haul COVID and the chronic illness debate. And finally, 3 days before the Senate trial began, why the U.S. needs the Romney family plan. After Donald Trump was acquitted by the Republican Senate, we had his first two columns were about an obituary for Rush Limbaugh and then the COVID emergency must end. So for a guy who seems so convinced about how, like, you know, that the time to do it was then, I don't see Ross doing a lot of heavy lifting or even engaging on the question of Trump's. I mean, like, you know, he sort of wrote about it in passing once.
Yeah. I had one. This is really the Kamala point. That's very good. I did not, was not prepared with his full list of his columns from January through February 2021. I did have one failing, though.
I mean, I wasn't either. I'm just ticking this off from memory. Maybe
I know. And I think this is good. You didn't do any op on this. I think this is good going forward. It's another reason I want to have these conversations is that, like, for as, you know, as we might describe, you know, that point of view as not having a ton of coherence, there's a lot of people that have it. Right. Like not there's it's not like 51% like him and Chris Sununu want, but there's a decent percentage of kind of important voters, frankly, that have his point of view. And so I do think my one failing is and now looking back is when you're having conversations with people like this in your life going ahead to November, there was one thing that he was kept doing that I was not prepared for because it just didn't even occur to me, which is that Joe Biden is responsible for like everything that happens everywhere in the world during his presidency. And yet, like, so Donald Trump is not responsible for COVID or George Floyd or any of the racial stuff.
Right. Yeah. No. And Ross is telling the Trump presidency ended in 2019.
Right.
Right. There is no 2020.
And so I think I could have pushed back on that more. And I just, I guess I just wasn't prepared for the rebuttal because it does seem so nonsensical to me that like Joe Biden has to be, is responsible for the Iranian attack on Israel, and yet Donald Trump is not responsible for the COVID deaths in America. And so I do think kind of preparing that sort of rebuttal for, you know, whatever, 4th of July barbecue with Uncle Joe, it might be something that's useful.
I will say this. I want everybody to live as their authentic selves. And listen,
like Mike
to,
Pence, by the way. I wish like we could Mike free Pence. Ross to be like God, Mike Pence, who's Mike too Pence. Honest now and is able to just let his freak flag fly.
Our boy. You know, so Ross spent a lot of time talking about how great all the outcomes were during the Trump years. Again,
yes.
He didn't mention the final year. I didn't hear a lot. Like what I would have asked Trump is, so what I would have asked Ross was, why not Trump? Why not? I mean, things were okay. Something else he said really struck me. So Ross spent a lot of his time castigating people about being alarmists, right? And you asked him, you know, if I had come back to you in 2015 and showed you what happened in 2020, would you have said like, you know, oh, it was, I'm being alarmist? And Ross was like, oh, no, everything. I thought it would be much, much worse. I think Ross is the only person I've ever heard say that he thought the Trump years turned out to be much better than he'd expected. And as I started having that thought, then I realized, no, that's not true. There are lots of people who say that. Those people are J.D. Vance and Matt Schlapp and all the people who support Donald Trump now. And so Ross is just with those guys. And I wish he could just say it and he'd be happier. He'd be a more fulfilled person and he'd be true to his authentic self and it'd be fine.
I don't know if that's right. I don't know. AB, what about you? Did Donald Trump surprise you? Did he?
Were things all so much better?
Enriched at all by the Trump years or pleasantly?
This is another occasion for me to, I've told this story before, but for anyone in the audience who doesn't know it, I think sometime in 2019, Tim and I did get the chance to see each other at 30 Rock in New York in between MSNBC hits. And I said, no, if he wins next year, there will be tanks in the street and women won't work. And Tim Miller said to me at the time, oh, I'm not as dark as, I'm not there. Like, okay, maybe that's, I'm sorry for you. Like,
wow, I'm in a really bad place, by the way, but that was like, wow, okay.
That was, I was too far for him, which is why I have this reserve of rage for people like John Kelly, who now are telling us it was really bad, who knew then how bad it would be if he won in November of 2020 and we didn't have January 6th. We just had the second term of Donald Trump in which he was going to do Project 2025 for 2021 and pull us out of NATO and completely give everything to Vladimir Putin. So they all knew that. They didn't warn us. And then we had to get what we got. So no, I always expected a man who told me in 2015 that he had no time or use for the Congress or the Constitution or the courts. I heard him loud and clear. I expected the worst, but still November and December of 2020, the 2 months of the coup that we had to cover at the granular level that most Americans are still unaware of. And then January 6th, of course, was definitely worse than
All right, one last thing, then we'll get out of this. The only other thing I would ask about is, so Ross wrote a book with Raihan Salam called Grand New Party, in which he was arguing for a more populist, he didn't say nationalist, but it was a very populist Republican Party, and he got it. We have the populist Republican Party. I think Ross thought that Yuval Levin would be in charge of a populist Republican Party, but it turns out not to have been that way.
Well,
this is just one more thing where I'd like ask. So you got the things.
Well, we did. No,
do
we
you
did
like it and are happy with it? Because I think he is. And that's OK.
I know you just want him to say likes Trump. But we did get into this just a little bit on the topic of
abortion.
Yep. When he was talking about how we should be supporting parents and we should have all these programs that help parents. And you know, I was like, well, I don't think that there are a lot of pro-lifers that are for that. And Ross was like, well, no, there are a couple who are your favorites at the Bulwark. And he mentions J.D. Vance and Marco and Hawley.
A lot of legislation coming out of them, huh?
Yeah. And like, that's my thing. It's just like, that's just not true. I we saw this with Garrett Graves. This circles us back to Garrett Graves.
The dream palaces,
right.
Tim.
You know, it circles back to Garrett Graves, right? As soon as Joe Biden if God willing, he's elected next year, if he starts in February and is like, I'm calling Ross to the White House and I'm calling Chris Murphy and Elizabeth Warren and J.D. Vance, and we're going to come up with a program to support mothers in red states, you know, where abortion is illegal, and we're going to have, you know, paid leave and extra access to medical care and blah, 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 whatever it is. The minute that happens, every one of those guys are like, nope, peace, I'm out. Right? Like none of the, like maybe JD. I will say JD has just, I have a lot of things I hate about JD, but I will say one thing. He has shown that he's like willing to work with some Democrats on a few things, and that he seems, I don't know, it seems like it's a relatively genuine pivot from to this populist person that he's become. But like Hawley, Marco, you're telling me Marco is going to do is going to co-bill with Elizabeth Warren and Chris Murphy on some kind of bill to help poor mothers? Like, okay, I'll believe it when I see it. I think I'm going to eat my hat. Maybe had Mitt Romney been forced out of the party, he might have done that. He's been pushing for the child tax credit. And again, maybe JD, maybe Susan Collins. But like, that's it. Like, that's, there's just, this isn't authentic. It's not authentic. The
Republican voters don't like this stuff. Yeah, I don't know if you guys remember, but in Sarah's focus groups, back when the American Rescue Plan was passed, and there was this fantastic child tax credit, which is the sort of thing that these people would like, right? That I like very much. And you listen to the focus groups, and the Republicans in the focus groups hated it. And they're like, we're paying people to have babies. These welfare people, believe me, the minute they get the sense that like, oh, this is going to maybe help some brown mothers. Yeah. They are out, my friend.
Maybe.
So,
maybe you seem champing at the bit to make one point on
no,
that.
I so appreciate the honesty that pro-lifers like Mona Charon and David French and JVL have offered up about what the movement is doing, about the lack of support for mothers and families in crisis pregnancies, the acknowledgement that most abortions are women who already have children, who feel that they can't have another child. And this, his discomfort about the gamble, right? The moral call of supporting Trump to therefore protect more babies. You could just, he was still rationalizing his choice instead of saying, this is what we wanted in 2016. This was our goal. It's a pure goal. It's a good goal. It's a moral goal. Instead, he was squirming around again and not being straight about what the pro-life movement ended up with and what they are happy to take today.
Number of abortions are up. Abortions are rising for the first time since the 1990s. Just saying. It's just a thing that's happening since we're talking about outcomes. All right, guys, good show. Long show. Incredibly long show. May 1st, Philadelphia. I feel like Tim and I did cut a promo on this. And I felt like this was the old school WWE days when you would get Hulk Hogan coming out. We're coming to Phoenix, brother. And then in June 17th, we're going to be in Oakland's Coliseum. We're going to be May 1st in Philadelphia, my hometown, my real hometown. I can't wait to be there. Maybe we'll all do a meetup at Geno's or something. I don't know. And then we're May 15th in D.C., which is Tim's spiritual hometown. Mm. And I will be there. I won't be happy about it. I'll be thrilled. AB, thanks for being here. Tim, thanks for just being amazing. Thanks for doing interesting, tough interviews and doing them in such a way that is kind and gentle and authentic.
It's doing my best. It's a rare gift. I appreciate that. And we love you, AB. Thanks for being on the pod.
Okay. Bye, guys.